Now, before I introduce Natalie Moore, I would like to take a minute to acknowledge our co-host, the City Club of Chicago. If you've never worked with Anne-Marie St. Germain and Amanda Augusto, you should. They are fantastic. I would like to acknowledge your board. So if you all could please stand. Thank you. Now on with the show. To be honest, our moderator this morning really needs no introduction. Natalie is an award-winning author and WBEZ Southside reporter, where she covers segregation and inequality. Her enterprise reporting has tackled race, housing, economic development, food injustice, and violence. She writes a monthly column for the Chicago Sun-Times. And can we please give a big round of applause for Natalie Moore?
Your dad's friend is in the front row. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. So I'm going to introduce our panelists. First, we have Kathy Cohen, a leading scholar of race and politics, and someone who I love to interview. She's author of The Boundaries of Blackness, AIDS, and the Breakdown of Black Politics and Democracy Remixed, Black Youth and the Future of American Politics. Today, Kathy shares the results of a recent study examining how race and ethnicity shape the millennial experience and how young people think about their city and futures. We have Jamal Cole, a champion of social justice. As you can see, he's founder and CEO of My Block, My Hood, My City. Jamal creates experiential education for teens and service year-round to Chicago communities. Traveling, mentorship, and community organizing are the subjects of his books and speeches. And then, finally, we have Michelle Morales. Michelle is CEO of MCPA Challenge Illinois, where she leads a staff of 27 focused on professional development and training to more than 250 Chicago public schools teachers in the areas of action civics and student-centered teaching, as well as facilitating youth councils that inform major city institutions. Michelle is a fellow of Leadership Greater Chicago. So I'm going to give you a little rundown of what this morning is going to be like. We're going to hear from each of the panelists, and you should have cards on your chair so you can write questions, and then those questions will come to me, and I'll sift through those and ask them on your behalf. So let's start with you, Kathy. Let's talk about your research. I know you've got some slides.
I do. It's a professor in me, right? I'm getting down, I'm going to show you slides, I'm going to walk around. I hope that's okay.
Yes, it's yes. Okay.
Whatever.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to start. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Is everybody doing okay?
Yeah.
You're awake? Engaged? Here we go. Here we go. So the project that I want to talk to you about is actually this report. It's on race and place, young adults, and the future of Chicago. One of my co-authors and co-directors, Margaret Brower, is here. Margaret, wave your hand. Thank you. The reason, I mean, there are many reasons to point out Margaret. The other co-director and co-author is David Knight. He's not able to be here. One of the amazing things about being a faculty member, a professor at the University of Chicago, is they're just brilliant, brilliant graduate students to work with. And it's really because of the graduate students that we did this project. Gen Forward is generally a bi-monthly survey of young adults, 18 to 34. Our findings are in the media. Our media partner is NBC News, right? Our focus is really on kind of amplifying the voices of young people of color. But Margaret and David came to me and said, we need to do something in Chicago, since we are in Chicago. It's something we've been wanting to do. And we decided to do something a little different. We decided to go into five neighborhoods: Inglewood, Pilsen, Chinatown, Albany Park. Northside is a compilation of a number of Northside neighborhoods. and not just survey young people, but actually sit down with them and talk with them for an hour to 2 hours about their experiences in Chicago. The questions range from neighborhood experiences to, for example, perceptions and experiences with violence, to feelings of freedom, safety, and joy. You can see all the questions, in fact, that we covered, or all the topics that we covered. And so I want to just provide a few of the findings, right, just to set the kind of context for this discussion. If we think about something like the racial economy that we call here in Chicago, one of the things we know already is that the concentration of jobs is largely in the Loop or on the North Side, and that suggests that, in fact, African-American young adults have to travel out of their neighborhood to find the job that, in fact, they might want. It is that travel outside of their neighborhood, they detail for us, is that that's when, in fact, they experience racial discrimination in looking for jobs. But what's interesting for us is that Latinx and Asian American young people talk less about racial discrimination because, in fact, they said they were able to find jobs in their neighborhood, but those jobs were largely kind of service or pink collar jobs, which paid minimum wage and had fewer benefits. And so eventually, to have the type of mobility that they wanted, they would also have to travel outside their neighborhood. But part of what we want to do is to talk about the nuances in young people's experience based on where they live and what's available in their neighborhoods. My block, my hood, is that what it's called? Yeah, I know. If we look at something like education, this is just a slide to remind us of the large numbers of Latinx and Asian and African American young people in CPS, but their lack of representation in selective enrollment schools, right? And we heard repeatedly from young people about in particular young people of color, about their kind of anxiety and also anger about having to leave their neighborhoods to get quality education. When we ask about kind of political representativeness and the responsiveness of your elected official, I heard that, Again, it's nuance, right? Among Asian Americans in Chinatown and Bridgeport, they felt that their representatives were negligent, right? They might suggest that they supported an idea or a project, but then didn't come through with the money. And Latinx young people in Pilsen found their representatives to be distrustful. And what I mean by distrustful is they felt like their representatives were supporting, for example, developers and were pushing out people who had lived in their neighborhoods for a very long time. Among African Americans, they said their representatives were largely invisible. They didn't see them, they didn't walk the block, they didn't know who to contact. Now here's the interesting thing. Well, this is all interesting. But when we talked to young whites on the North Side, they found their representatives to be responsive. No, I know. Say it isn't so. They felt like they had influence and power over their representatives, right? And so even in terms of thinking about political responsiveness, we see differences depending on race and place. Okay. Just really quickly also, if we ask a question about what's the most important issue to your neighborhood, again, race and place matters. In Pilsen, young people said gentrification. In Inglewood, they talked about concerns with violence. Chinatown, Bridgeport, education, and the lack of kind of quality schooling in their neighborhoods. And on the North Side, it wasn't violence, it was crime and gun control that they said they worried about. Policing and violence. The reason we include this slide is just to remind folks that, of course, there's concern about police brutality, but young people also talked about the police just being unresponsive and neglectful, right? Calling someone at 2 in the morning because they hear shots, and the police arriving at 12 p.m. the next day and being dismissive in terms of the call. This leads to something that we found very interesting, of course, is that 20% of African-American young people, or I should say young adults, say they would not call the police under any circumstances if it couldn't be avoided. They said it just escalates the situation. They feel like they're put in harm's way, and they're looking for new ways to think about safety in their neighborhood outside of just relying on the police. Gentrification and displacement, we want to include this slide to remind us that, yes, gentrification is an issue, for example, in Pilsen, but young people in Inglewood also talked about kind of displacement with businesses purchasing residential properties. And, you know, part of what's in this report, how am I doing on time? I said, great. Okay, great. All right, you didn't even look. I like that. Part of what's in the report is that we try to include quotes so that you can hear directly from young people, right? In this case, an Asian American man in Chinatown, Bridgeport, talked about the influx of newer, younger money, right, that might be displacing people. And in an African American woman in Inglewood talked about that there have been people in the neighborhood 20, 30, 50, 60 years that are being pushed out, right, because of new businesses, and pushed out for new businesses where they can't even afford to shop, right? So there is a, we talk about kind of population loss. For these young people, it is push out. It's not kind of intentional that, oh, I just want to leave. They're being pushed out because of the lack of investments and opportunities in their neighborhoods. We didn't want this to just be a deficit model, right? There are positives happening in neighborhoods. And one of the things that we found is that young people talked about their sources of joy within their neighborhoods, right? And that there's an investment in their neighborhoods, that those, in fact, who feel safe in their neighborhoods are more likely to stay in their neighborhoods. If you have a stronger sense of connection in your neighborhood, you're more likely to stay in the city of Chicago. Now, that being said, when we ask about future outlook, do you think you'll stay in the city? Do you don't know, or do you expect to move away? Again, 48% of young people in Inglewood said that they thought they would move away eventually. And they said they felt like, gotcha, they felt like they were being pushed out, right? The lack of economic opportunities, the lack of quality schooling, the disinvestment. And again, this wasn't, we want to leave, we feel like we're being pushed out. All right, so let's end with just two visions of Chicago. Jeremiah says, I'd hate to see Chicago 25 years from now, and there are no black people anywhere, right? You barely see us. And it's really, I think, this last line that's important. He says, I just want something better. Anthony says, and he has a vision for Chicago, I hope for a thriving, blossoming, big city in which everyone, no matter or regardless of their socioeconomic background, neighborhood, or religion, can come to attain opportunities to get on a path to success. A city that's embracive of all people, inclusive of all people, a city where there is a place for everybody at the table, right? So again, I think, you know, the work that we're trying to do is to talk about the complexity of experiences that young people have in this city, the question of whether, in fact, they will be embraced, supported, and provided the opportunities they deserve, or whether we will continue a kind of pattern of disinvestment, in particular on the south and west sides, and push those young people who are a resource for the city out of the city. Thank you.
Michelle?
Oh, I too have slides. Probably the former teacher in me. And so we were asked to respond to a couple of things in Dr. Cohen's report. Obviously, MCFA Challenge, we work with young people, building civic engagement and civic leadership, much more than that. Civics is way more than just that. And so obviously in her report, she talks about politics, spaces for democracy, pipelines to politics, unequal access to politicians. And the other thing I wanted to respond to is sort of the safety, freedom, and joy aspect in the report. And so these are just a couple of slides to frame the problem, right? These were polls taken that really came out in 2016 or after the 2016 elections of just Americans in general. And 80% of Americans believe that our democracy is in trouble. There's a decrease in civic knowledge. We know that educational systems don't invest in civic education anymore. That's resulted in a decrease of not only civic knowledge, but civic engagement. 18% of Americans say that only 18% believe that they can trust the government to do what's right. So that distrust of young people extends to adults as well. Less than half of young Americans vote, even in presidential elections. And 24% of U.S. millennials, and this is across races, consider democracy to be a bad way of running a government. Okay? So obviously this, you see, we look a lot at MCFA Challenge at access to civics, access to civic engagement, and as we all know, unfortunately, the numbers match every other number in terms of inequities. Young people of color are not getting access to civics and are spending much less time on civics than they are in math and science. One thing I want to say is the one-year anniversary of the Parkland shooting. You know, a lot of people were shocked and amazed at how those young people advocated. You want to know where they learned their skills? In their government class. Their school actually heavily invests in civic programming. And they learned, they actually did a simulation a week before the shooting of how to advocate to the NRA. So you see how they use the skills in a classroom environment, in real life, to push an issue and to catalyze a movement. That is the dream of civics. And our Black, Brown, and Asian students are not getting this in their classrooms, for the most part. I would say CPS is doing a big job of investing in this, but nationally it's still an issue. So, you know, students of color are often less in less democratic environments. We know that they're in schools that are tightly controlled, where voice does not matter. God forbid you have an opinion. I can't tell you the amount of times we, and these are even young people who attend selective enrollment schools who are of color, who say that when they come to MCFA Challenge, it's the first time they've been asked what they thought of an issue. That's a damn shame. For a teenager to never be asked what they think of anything, right? Then we wonder why the millennial vote is so low. We wonder why at 18 they're not rushing to the polls. So just another one, uninformed, disempowered, right? So, you know, one of the things we do at MCFA is really to create space where young people can express their ideas, where they can take ownership over their city, where they can feel that they can create change, that their thoughts have power behind them, that their expertise comes from their lived experience. Another thing that we dismiss young people, right? You're not old enough, you don't know enough, what do you know, right? And that's the paradigm shift we try to create at MCFA Challenge, is actually, no, you do know. And you know based on what you've experienced, you know based on your life, you know based on what you've experienced in your community, the disempowerment, the marginalization, the racism. So how can you now bring that wisdom? How can we then give you the tools to advocate on behalf of yourself, your family, your community, your city? One thing I want to say in terms of civic is civic requires ownership, right? Your involvement in civics, your engagement in civics, rushing to the polls, calling your legislator, engaging with your alderman, all means that you feel ownership over your city, your community, your home. And I'm going to say, when we look at the media and we see how young people who come downtown for spring break are treated and met with police officers, that right there tells you they're already being told, this city is not for you. Okay? And if the city is not for you, then how do we then blame these very same students for lack of civic engagement? So, people know I love to make calls to action. There's a lot of people in the room that maybe have some influence, some power, some political will, maybe not. But this, I keep thinking of all the media in the last couple of months. Millennials got blamed for low voter turnout in the February and April elections. That's all the media focused on, was the millennial. They didn't look at anything else. Everybody had low voter turnout. They only honed in on the millennial vote. And obviously the media about what happened over spring break. We cannot, as adults, continue this pattern of disinvestment, of not creating structures, not pushing political will to create infrastructure and support and services in communities, and then blame the very young people who are, to be quite blunt, survivors and victims of the crap we put in place, that they're not engaged enough. Okay? So part of my job at MCFA is not just to create spaces for young people and to make sure that they are treated for the brilliance and the creativity that they all have regardless of their walk of life, but to advocate on their behalf and to create more open spaces for them. And it's something we see, honestly, across the board. We just did an event where we engaged youth from suburban areas. Yes, they have different issues. Suburban students are clamoring to get involved politically, right? Young people in Chicago from any community are clamoring to get involved politically. And yet, civic institutions shut their doors on young people. They do not treat them as a constituent. They do not even speak to them. We hold annual, for every major election, we try to do a WTTW event where we have young people. And every time we joke that candidates should have to appear in front of young people as a requirement for them getting elected, because you can see immediately when the first question comes out of the mouth of a young person that the candidates weren't prepared for it. That they showed up thinking this would be a dance and pony show. And when the first question comes out, you watch them mentally recalibrate. You know, and so until we take them seriously, and I'm going to say this from every walk of life. I have a 14-year-old. You know, the unifying thing we have all gone through is puberty. Okay? So it unifies us human-wide, right? Yet we make fun of it. We dismiss it. We treat it as though it's a disease, a disorder. We treat young people are fodder for jokes. Right? We joke about teenagers. We joke about millennials. We joke about the way they think or whatever, right? We joke about puberty. We make jokes at their expense. Those jokes are serious because then it informs our lens on how they should be engaged. And it informs us on whether or not we're going to invite them in. So my challenge always is we need to start diminishing the bias we have against young people. Obviously, the demonization of young people, particularly young people of color. They wouldn't. When I saw that media stuff, I'm still very angry about it, as you can tell, because I work downtown. MCFA Challenge is located downtown, and we're met every summer by the onslaught of Lollapalooza. And I will tell you that when we have to walk to meetings downtown, confronted by the Lollapalooza masses, they're no different than the kids who went downtown for spring break. In fact, they're worse. And yet the cops are not there arresting anyone. So again, right, the racism in our policing, the racism of how we treat young people of color, and then we're blaming those very young people for not engaging. So sorry for the angry tone, but that's still, can't let go of it. It's still on my mind, and it is something that we're trying to overcome at MCFA, because the safety, joy, and freedom aspect of Dr. Cohen's report, young people have so much love for this city, and want to see the city be better for them and their families, and want to stay, and want to create change. We just have to get out of the way, support them, and let them. And until more of us can't do that, you're going to continue to see the same sort of disengagement. And I do this because they actually are engaged. It's just that we get in the way and prevent their engagement. So, thank you. I have more slides.
I can hold it. I can. Yes, Jamal. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Guess I'll stand up like everybody else did. I work with a lot of youth, and they always tell me I'm a product of my environment. I'm a victim of my circumstances. I'm in the trenches. You know, that's what they tell me. I'm in the trenches, right? I think you're a product of your expectations, but I definitely think your environment affects your well-being. Come on. I take students on educational field trips from the divested communities. I take them to, we might go to a chiropractor, and we might talk about sports management, you know, or we might take them to Gatorade. They learn about consumer engagement. They never knew that job existed prior to us taking them there, right? That's what I do, and we have a 15-passenger van, so we drop them off on their blocks at night. Right? I was dropping a young lady off on her block, and I think it was North Lawndale, 13th and Christiana. And when we pulled up, there was yellow crime scene tape from her porch all the way to the alley. And one of the kids in the van, they said, oh man, that's just yellow tape. That's regular stuff. It ain't serious unless it's the red tape. That's when you know it's a body. The kids in the car, they was like, true, true. They was 15 years old. They was already forensic scientists, right? Facts, man. I took another kid, Eric, dropped him off out south on 63rd and Western. We had to drop him off like about three houses down. As soon as he jumped out the van, he ran to his car like there was a shooting. Right? That's how many, he was so scared, that's how many shootings be on his block. Right? Last kid we dropped off way back out west, I think it was 55th or something, like West North, right next to El Gran Burrito, right? Kendall. When Kendall was getting out, I said, listen, man, I said, Look, Kendall, you got to respect the van, man. Grab some of these McDonald's bags. All the kids eat is McDonald's. Right? You ask them how far away from their school they live. They say, I live 3 McDonald's away. Right? That's all they eat is McDonald's. I said, Kendall, take some of these bags, man. It's too many McDonald's bags. Take some with you. Throw them out when you get inside. He's like, cool. He took 4 or 5 of the value meal bags, jumped out the van. As soon as he got out the van, threw all of them on the ground like it was just regular, like it was a piece of gum, just threw 5 big bags on the ground, right? Man, it got me thinking on the way home. I was thinking, like, man, like how many times do you have to see yellow tape before you're just like, oh, man, you know what? Summertime's on the way. Like, how many shots do you have to hear before you tell yourself they firecrackers? You go back to sleep, right? How many times do you walk by a vacant lot with trash in it before you just become disengaged? You don't even notice the trash is there. And if you push a stroller with a baby in it past the vacant lot with trash, hey, does the baby grow up thinking the trash is regular? I think it do, because your environment affects your well-being. What I'm trying to say is it eats at your physical reflexes, man. You go to the hospital, you see a doctor, he hits your knee with a reflex hammer, he wants to see if there's something wrong with your central nervous system. If he hits your knee with that reflex hammer and there's no knee-jerk reaction, something's wrong. You walk in front of your crib, it's trash on the ground, you don't pick it up, something's wrong. You hear shots on your block, you don't call the cops, something's wrong. Something's wrong with the community's nervous system, man. I always tell people, it's like you ever been to somebody's house and you watching TV and a mouse run right out in front of the TV? It happens so fast, you can't even act like you don't see it. You just say, dang. And a person's house, that is, they so used to having mice, they ain't got no reaction. There's no jolt of embarrassment, no fear, no shame, no nothing. No physical reflexes. A couple minutes later, the mouse come back out. This time he bring his friends and say, come on out, y'all. It's safe. They don't mind. They ain't got no physical reflexes. They used to things being decrepit. We can get all the crumbs we want. It's the same thing with the drug dealer on 79th and Cottage. Right in front of Happy's Liquors, man. He served his drugs all month. Next month he tell his friends, come out here, y'all. They don't mind. Store owner don't mind. He ain't got no physical reflexes. He used to things being decrepit. We can sell all the drugs we want. That's what I saw police officers do. Came to the crib, shot a kid down 16 times. They don't mind. Ain't nobody in this community gonna do. They ain't got no physical reflexes. They used to things being decrepit. We can shoot all the kids we want. It's not regular, man. It's not regular in our communities when I'm taking kids home. German Shepherd sniffy kids on 79th Street when I get on a train in the morning. It's not regular. It's not regular for there to be, I come into a helicopter's land, they go up and down like dragonflies. My daughter knew what a helicopter was before she knew what a butterfly was. It's not regular to have to order your food every morning through bulletproof glass windows. If y'all just ate y'all food through a bulletproof glass window, you just got your coffee, you'll be traumatized. Man, it's not regular for every billboard in my community to promote cheap divorces and $6,000 tax advances. It's not regular for there to be 15 currency exchanges and no banks. How am I supposed to save? It's not regular for there to be a liquor store in every other corner. Look, I might as well get drunk. It's not regular for there to be a holding cell in the basement of a funeral home. It ain't regular for there to be paddy wagons parked outside the front of the high school. Kids got to take their belt off and their shoes off at the airport, get into the school, wear a clear book bag, man. The school's got 20 teachers and there's 12 substitute teachers in the whole school. That ain't regular. It's crazy, man. I talked to a kid, I said, man, what you do this weekend? He said, I had a great weekend, Jamal. Had fun. Ate some good food, got to dance, saw some fun. I said, what you do? What, y'all go to Six Flags or something? He said, no, man, I just went to 79th and Cottage. I was at Leaks. This is the best funeral I've ever been to. Kids, sophomore's been a 12 funeral. It ain't regular. And like it's regular, they say we work with at-risk youth. Man, I just think the integrity of this whole city is at risk. And we're not supporting programs that work with youth. Thank you guys for having me, man.
I need a moment. moment after hearing all of this to process. I'm going to go through some of these questions. We did have two pre-submitted questions, and the first one is from Sarah Martinez from Mikvah Challenge. Is she a student? Oh, hi. Okay. There is often scholarly research that studies urban youth and their experiences. How do we make sure that we make research accessible and understandable to youth when they are trying to advocate for change in their communities? So I'm going to put that to you first, Kathy.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, there are many, many ways in which we can think about how do we make research accessible. I think the first thing is, who are you in conversation with? Who do you see as your audiences? Who do you talk to? I feel like at the work that we do at Gen Ford and the Black Youth Project, we've had a long history of working, in particular, with young Black activists, from BYP 100 to BLM to Let It Breathe Collective to R3, right? And so we are always in conversation and thinking about what's the type of research that supports the work, sometimes work that regular folks and institutional people don't like, work that will advance a discourse and dialogue. So that's the first thing. Second thing is to put it in a way that isn't just another book that gets published by a university and gets put on a shelf, right? So, you know, could we have written, this looks like a book. You said it's going to be your book club, right? No, it is not a book, right? I know, it feels like a book. But one of the things we tried to do is just to publish it as a report, which makes it a little more accessible. I have these one-pagers. We also have one-pagers that people can take. The most important thing for us is also to be in conversation in small settings. So this is one small setting. We've done stuff at UIC. We've done stuff at the Urban League. We've done stuff with BYP. I mean, so to also be in conversation. The last thing, I guess, I will say about kind of doing research is that along the way, you always want young people to be a part of what you're thinking about, helping you think about the questions, helping you think about the purpose, helping you think about the dissemination. So I'll go back really quickly and say our first big project thinking about young people, right? I thought, okay, well, we'll do this big survey and then we'll write a book. And the young people around the room were like, that's not going to happen. We've got to create something. And what we created was the Black Youth Project, right? And it is now a site on the web, I say, where young Black people can speak for themselves without censorship. It has probably 5,000 visitors a day, right? It is a space where young people dictate what they want to talk about and the things that are important to them. And I think the other thing, there's a longer discussion about restructuring universities to prioritize and recognize this type of work in the same way that they recognize somebody writing a book that 15 people are going to read, right? And so what becomes a priority of institutions with power?
And reminder that there are staffers who are collecting questions. This question is from Anne Marie for all the panelists. Given today's theme and related issues, what advice do you have for Mayor-elect Lightfoot? You all knew that that question was going to happen, either from me or from the audience.
I can take a stab at it. Yeah. I feel like, just go beyond having empathy. Like, you hear about something happening in Kenya, you might be empathetic and want to support. I'm empathetic. I see it happening. Yeah. But I think leaders go beyond empathy and have compassion and actually do something about it. And if when you lead with compassion and people can see it, you give them a way. There's a lot of Chicagoans that want to get involved, don't know how. How do I get involved? So actually, instead of talking about it, do it. That's compassion. So that would be my advice. That's why I like when I saw her on King Drive hanging lights. She actually showed up, grabbed a box, and went to work. I was like, oh, we're going to work good together. That's cool. You actually got some compassion. So pick up your shovel, shovel your neighbor's snow, do something, have compassion, go beyond empathy. That would be my suggestion.
We are
privileged that we're facilitating the Youth Transition Committee for Mayor-elect Lightfoot.
My hope is that continues beyond the transition process. I hope that youth voice is integrated throughout the administration. My hope is that they're integrated into policymaking. My hope is that before policy is pushed out, that it is reviewed by young people so that the young people can say, hang on a minute, your policy is actually going to create barriers for me and my community. That's something we do with other civic leaders. As we all know, there's a big disconnect between policy and implementation. And sometimes policy may mean the best, and the way it's implemented, it creates enormous barriers for people. And we all know that young people are at the receiving end of any single policy that's passed, whether it was intended or not. And that's the one thing I'm hoping she integrates, is there's often this disconnect in, oh, we're just talking about transportation. Well, young people use transportation. Or we're just talking about, well, young people use that. And so this site, we're really trying to make sure that the administration understands that every single thing you push out impacts young people. So please make sure you have them at the table.
I would agree with everything my two panelists have said. I'd also suggest that she invest in accountability. And what I mean by that is, how do you build out an infrastructure of accountability? How do you support civic and political organizations that you may not like it at times, but will say and rise up and say, this can't happen anymore, right? And that's about the new mayor-elect, but it's also about foundations and the philanthropic community here in Chicago. Are we serious enough to put money and power in the hands of young people so that they can move their own agenda and hold elected officials and all of us in this room and up here accountable for what they believe is a kind of progressive agenda that embraces and empowers young people? So I would say, put some money up front and let's fund an infrastructure, a civic engagement infrastructure, headed by and controlled by young people to hold everyone accountable.
And I was going to say, and be okay that that accountability doesn't look like our accountability.
That's exactly right, yeah.
This question is from Kenneth Newman. For the five CPS high schools that were mentioned on the screen, this would be for you, Kathy, are north of the Eisenhower Expressway.
Yes.
And four of the five schools are east of the Kennedy. When neighborhoods like Lawndale, South Chicago, Little Village, Inglewood, Woodlawn, and Deering don't have their own high-performing schools, do students in these communities have a chance?
I'm going to tell the group, no one remembers Lindblom.
Yeah.
Lindblom's in Englewood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My son goes there. I am blessed he goes there. Every morning I drop him off and I see black and brown babies walking into that school. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow it's never included in the rankings. So I just want to, I need to do a shout out for Lindblom.
And I just want to add to that that Lindblom is one of the top schools in the state as well as the city.
So I want to push back though. Yeah. Yes, Lindblom, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a problem when we can name the quality schools.
Yeah.
Right? So I think the slide probably should have maybe sent a different message, which is to say we need to rethink the idea that selective enrollment schools are the places where you go to get quality education.
Right.
Like what we heard from young people was that, maybe I can go into that school, but when I come back, there's friction in my community because I got to go out and then come back. I want to be able to walk down the street and feel like, I'm getting the education that I deserve. So it's not just about those schools and what's excluded, but that we can name the schools that provide quality education. That's ridiculous and unacceptable.
This question is from a parent. How practical is the saliency of change when the programs don't help the very parents? It's like we reach past the parents to infiltrate the children. It's like another form of conditioning of accountability. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, my children are not part of the whole narrative of all my life I had to fight. I get that. However, we have gone through some very harrowing situations of being scammed and things of that nature. But what I found most difficult is that one of my sons is a part of a very brilliant program. He comes home and talks about all these wonderful ideas, and I'm sitting here like, but the landlord still hasn't fixed such and such, so now we gotta move, or I've gotta go through this situation. And it's like, I want my child to have hope, and a lot of children, I think, are not different from, very different from that. Whereas every parent, every low-income parent cannot, it's not, it's like a form of a, I'm a retired librarian, y'all, and I live in the hood, okay? Mm. My kids don't eat hot Cheetos for breakfast in the morning. My kids don't even do school lunches. We make lunches every morning. So it's almost as if people want to care for my kids and say, oh, I'm so sorry for you. You too can have hope. I'm like, but my mom is not at home being the very thing that you think that you're trying to save her from. So when do you say, okay, let's have a program that now only reaches out to the children, but let's say what's going on at home. It's like, how can you fix the child and talk about the very conditions that they're suffering when their parents have been the first person that had to experience it? Their parents are on the front line. And I know people will say, well, there are programs out there to help the parents, but you all know those programs don't work, because if they work, you wouldn't be having the civic outreach to the children that you do now. Mm-hmm. Children are avoiding because they are very representation of the very homes that they're in. And every home is not full of deadbeats, hot Cheetos, and rap music.
I think that.
That's my feeling.
Yeah, I think you should start it. Honestly, God, like, cause you, that passion that you have, that's like, it captures me. I feel like programs are programs, but people touch people. You know what I'm saying? I can't tell you how many Metro PCS bills I gotta pay, how many light bills I gotta pay, how many presents I get for Christmas and engage. The best part of my program is dropping the students off on their block and talking to their parents. Right? That's the best part. And you know what? That's why I don't, after our educational expirations, we don't drop the kids off at the school and say, oh, the parents got to come pick them up at 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. We actually drive every student home. That's the best part.
That's the part that I'm talking about, is the parent engagement.
Yeah.
Now, I talk to my son. My son is, full disclosure, my son is with MICA, and I love the work that they're doing. And I talk to my son about your policy ideas, and we're able to have very cogent conversations. I'm pro-labor. I don't apologize about that. And so I talked to him from a labor lens. Like, you can't go around telling people they got to do such and such. This is a cooperative environment. You got to use words like buy-in, be innovative. Mm-hmm. And I'm able to have those cogent conversations. I'm just, at some point in all of these great programs that my children are participating in, I'd love for there to be some summit that says, and now let's bring your parents to the table.
Yeah.
Let's see what your parents think about the policy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is there a way that you can partner with your parents? Mm. Because that's really about that's accountability. Right. Mm-hmm. And until we do that, it's as if that we are displacing the prioritization of family. And family is just as important in that whole partiality about civic engagement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what I will say to that is, MICFA's been around for 20 years. MICFA's never engaged parents. I'm just going to own that critique, right? About a year ago, we started a new program involving middle schools in various neighborhoods and neighborhood leadership councils. So getting them to talk about, create recommendations around violence in their community, because we noticed there wasn't youth voice in that process, and to begin to engage local aldermen. Parents would come and refuse to leave, right? Because they're babies. We're working with 13 and 15-year-olds. And so we were confronted for the first time, like, oh, shit, we got to figure out how to engage parents. And so through that program now, when we do our leadership cafes, parents come and engage in the leadership cafes. Parents now come and attend the leadership cafes, help to talk to elected officials. We include them in the icebreakers and things of that nature. That program broke the ground in that area, and that's really due to the supervisor who leads that program. And so we're now trying to figure out, how do we do that throughout our other programs? When we do a leadership cafe for our citywide youth councils, how do we have space for parents? When we're actually doing student interviews next week. In the past, it was you drop your kid off, they get interviewed. Now we're like, no, we need to talk to the parents about it. We need to let them know, this is what this program is about. This is what your young person's going to be learning. Do you have any questions? And so that we are trying to slowly shift and engage parents. It was never, I will be completely frank and own the critique, a priority for MICFA.
Well,
our gaze was...
And I'll be more than happy.
There you go.
City Club and U Chicago Engagement, making connections.
Yeah.
We have time for one more question. Patrick had three. I'm going to do the shortest one so we can have just like a rapid fire answer. and then each of you can have some closing statements. Should the voting age be lowered to 16?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sorry. I saw some remarks. I heard some. Young people at 16. Look, at 16, you are legally allowed to have sex with an older person. At 16.
That's true, people.
At 16, because I was shocked. I have a 21-year-old stepson. When I walked into the doctor's office with him at 16, and the doctor was like, "You can leave." I was like, "What?" HIPAA laws hit. Why can't you vote at 16? At 16, in most spaces, you are already on the path to adulthood and you are treated as though you are an adult. And yet, we still think that it's, again, this is us and our bias in thinking that a 16-year-old is not wise enough or smart enough to vote. That's what that is all about. That is our bias in terms of an age. So I absolutely agree the voting age should be at 16.
I don't care if you're 16 or 116. Mm-hmm. If it takes you 2 hours to vote and you ain't volunteered 2 hours that whole year, I don't think you should be able to vote. I think it's like the Preakness and the Belmont Stakes. We're just looking at people and saying, oh, who's the most popular person in the election? People spend all this time voting and no time volunteering on a block. Democracy starts from the block. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you can't expect big city government to take care of your block. You actually got to get out there and do it yourself. You can't expect no mayor demands that you know your next door neighbor. But if you want your block to be more connected, you got to demand that of yourself. Yeah. There ain't no alderman demanding that you pick up trash in your alley. Yeah. If you want there to be less rats born in your alley, you better demand that of yourself. Democracy starts on a block. So however long it took you to vote this year, just dedicate that 2 hours to your block, and I think the city would be better.
I agree that the city would be better. I think it starts on your block, but you absolutely have to demand things from the state, from the government, from the mayor, from the alderman. Yep. So I don't think it's an either or. To the point of 16, I thought we were going in the same place. I don't care if it's 16. What I care about is, in schools, are we preparing parents and young people to have informed decision-making with regard to the vote?
Yep.
Right? Are we bringing in information about who the candidates are? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about the issues in your community?
Right.
Are we preparing young people to advocate on their behalf? And are we dealing with issues of voter suppression? Right? So we can give people the vote at 16, but if they stop you from voting because they say you need an ID when you don't even need an ID, that's a bigger issue to me. So the 16 thing, okay, we can talk about 16, but let's talk about the system of voting and what people need to be to inform the vote and hold elected officials accountable.
Yep.
Any closing remarks from anyone?
I would just say, like, man, oppression is super real, and it's a structural part of this country and its history. It was created intentionally, and nowadays it's cloaked up in all these trumped up laws and false media, and people don't even recognize how injustice is being sustained in our community. Mm-hmm. I am telling you, our kids don't even know they're ordering food through bulletproof glass windows. They don't even know they got shot spotters on poles, all this reactionary technology in the community. So I just think that we need to like, do a better job of educating our kids and giving back where you can. So those are my closing comments.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank the University of Chicago Office of Civic Engagement, the City Club of Chicago, and of course, Michelle, Jamal, and Kathy for being so passionate and sharing with an audience this morning.